Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The Who once sang, "I hope I die before I get old." Well, those long-haired 70s layabouts were baby boomers for whom youth was sweet. Not so much for us contemporary youngsters. In this week's Telegram, we explore the battle of the generations, why many of us under 40 feel that the baby boomers are enjoying a luxurious retirement at our expense. Also, what is the matter with France? Racist comedians, unemployment, boss napping, why the model française is falling apart. I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's assistant editor Jeremy Warner, by Ed Hauker, the co-author of Jilted Generation, by Benedict Brogan, The Telegraph's deputy editor, and down the phone from Paris by The Telegraph columnist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet. Last week, the Prime Minister confidently told the nation that he was triple-locking pensions. The very next day, the Chancellor warned that the future would involve lots and lots of cuts for everyone under 65. Some would say that there's a pattern in all of this, that while baby boomer pensioners are being nicely looked after by the state, youngsters are getting it in the neck. Tuition fees, the abolition of education maintenance allowances, even a threat to cut all benefits for the under 25s, which both parties are thought to be looking into. The new generation complains that life is far harder than it was for their parents. You can't afford a house, jobs are in short supply, and even the TV is a bit rubbish. We've never had it so bad. But Jeremy Warner, the assistant editor of the Daily Telegraph and one of Britain's leading business and economics commentators, strongly disagrees. Jeremy, why is that?
Well, look, I don't deny that there is something in this, that like all complaints, there's an element of truth in this intergenerational unfairness thing. What I would say is that it is an inevitable consequence of an aging society. When there are more and more old people in society, they put democratic pressure on the politicians to favour, as it were, spending on the past, in particular pensions and healthcare, over investment in the future, infrastructure, education, and so on. That's an inevitable consequence of this age in which we live. It's a temporary age, and I think that eventually things will stabilise, generations will have roughly the same share, the population will stop growing. So right. It's a temporary problem.
But you agree that it's there, that the young are having a rougher time than their parents or grandparents.
Well, not entirely. I mean, what I was going to go on to say is that I think that this problem is exaggerated out of all proportion, and that there are actually much more important issues to worry about. And in particular, I would point to unfairness within generations, not between them. Right. It seems to me that the big divide is across age groups, not between them.
Ed Hauker, who wrote Jilted Generation, How Britain Has Bankrupted Its Youth. Do you agree with that?
No, not entirely. I suppose Jeremy obviously is very wise and brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's peculiar to hear him share in common the same complaint that has been levelled against those of us who complain that young people are in a particularly difficult position, as one made by Owen Jones of The Independent, the radical socialist sort of...
We've heard of him.
Angry man, yeah.
We've heard of him. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry that you have. Owen makes exactly the same point. He sort of says, well, look, you must concentrate on these inequalities within generations rather than between them. But the rather unfortunate position that young people, particularly in British society and actually in American society, in the developed world generally face at the moment, is that increasingly their life outcomes, their opportunities in terms of work, whether or not they can get on the housing ladder, whether indeed they can leave the family home, are predicated on what the financial position of their parents are. Because that group of people that Jeremy described is so wealthy and powerful, it increasingly becomes the case that you end up being your parents' child. Social mobility is stalling and slowing down. If your parents can afford to lend you or give you the money to buy a house, then you can buy a house or begin to afford a mortgage. If they are well-connected and can offer you lots and lots of opportunities, then you can get better jobs. You can perhaps move to areas where there's jobs growth, and they can help start you in life. But if you're very talented and poor, you're in a poorest position now because of the kind of cuts that this government, and indeed the government before it, put in place, than you would have been a few decades ago.
You do think it was different in the 60s and the 70s?
Well, I mean, it observably was. I mean, not least because, I mean, every reasonable metric of social mobility was showed that society was much more fluid and much more kind of dynamic in those decades for those generations. But there's just a welter of personal debts and difficulties that now lead young people in Britain to the position where, you know, if, you know, 40% of all those unemployed in Britain are aged under 30. I mean, it's a huge, you know, it's, unemployment is really concentrated in that group of people. Of them, they're more likely to live at home than any other generation by with their parents than obviously any other age group, and in greater numbers than before. So by 2020, almost 40% of them are going to be living with their parents up to the age of 30. They're essentially being infantilised, which I would have thought, you know, anybody with a free market bent would be extremely alarmed about.
Jeremy.
Well, I accept some of that, but the point is that, as I was saying earlier, this is a temporary phenomenon caused by the fact that people are living a lot longer than they used to. In the end,
how will it end? I mean, you say it's temporary one.
In the end, all wealth is recycled. It's recycled either because it's taxed or it's inherited or you know, it's quite often just squandered over. You know, even very serious amounts of wealth tend to get squandered within two or three generations, so it gets recycled back into the system. So,
so you're relying on these oldsters to make bad financial judgments.
Well it is obviously the case that people have to live with their parents at the family home for longer than they would have done in my generation, for instance. But eventually they will presumably inherit a certain amount of money, which will allow them to climb aboard the housing ladder. And of course, the solution to the housing problem is that we build a lot more houses. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that so many of those who vociferously complain about intergenerational unfairness are also very opposed to development in all its various forms, and the sort of development we need. A relaxation of planning controls to allow the affordable housing to get built in the southeast is a definite no-no to a lot of that group of people who complain about this issue.
Right. So it seems to me that Jeremy is saying that yes, this divide does exist, but it's a short-term problem, not helped by bad policy. You're saying it's something bigger than that. It's something really demographic and cultural that is here to stay.
Well. If that is the important point, and forgive me, but I'm not sure it is, then it strikes me that whether it's a short or long-term problem is entirely contingent on how we respond to it. And the first serious response to that demographic growth and the fact that people are living longer is the major account of why population is growing in Britain and indeed most of the Western world. The major challenge manifest in the late 1980s when government actuaries started warning increasingly loudly that public pensions were in a very, very bad way. Mm. And you get a lot of very serious economists concerned about it at that time as well. So, I mean, for decades, actually, Milton Friedman was concerned about unfunded public pensions. And he predicted there would be some kind of revolution or riot in the streets, because if they're not funded at the point at which they're safe for by the generations that later accept them, and there's a massive demographic hump, then inevitably those on costs to the rest of society grow. And that's precisely what we're seeing.
So yes, but that's an entirely affordable cost. I mean, and this government has basically succeeded in, as far as I can see, in stabilising it at about 4% of national income into the indefinite future. So I don't regard that as a major issue. It's a fairly marginal one.
It hasn't set up the problem of care, for example. It hasn't found us...
Well, or NHS spending.
Well, yeah.
Here we come on to the other point about all this. I mean, what do those who complain about intergenerational unfairness really propose to do about it? You know, you have have got this aging cohort coming through the system. And what do they propose? That you don't give them health care, that you don't give them a bare minimum of a state pension? I mean, you know, these are not solutions.
It's not a bare minimum, is it, Jeremy? I mean, it's triple locked. It's pretty decent, and it's been, and it means that actually people in their 80s in Britain have a higher disposable income than people in their 20s and 30s who are in work, right?
Well, only those who've saved for their old age on top of what they've paid into national insurance. And the other thing about the state pension is that the vast majority of those who receive it and will receive it in future, and by the way, you know, eligibility of it is going up every year. You know, you have to, by the time I retire, you know, I won't get in until I'm 68 or something like that. And so again, the government has done quite a lot to limit the cost to the public purse of this aging cohort.
Well, it's also not to expand.
But in any case,
you take the universal benefits. I mean, winter fuel allowance, free TV license,
Those are marginal costs.
They're marginal.
They're $2 or $3 billion.
But so were the education maintenance allowance. And in fact, if you look at what the government has saved as a result of its tuition fee reforms, which is virtually nothing, that's also a marginal cost.
Exactly. So, you're talking about very marginal sums of money.
But
it matters very much
to people, right? And the people who are being ignored by government policy are the young, whereas the people who these marginal costs have been repeatedly protected from, for the reasons that you admitted and completely explained, which is that there's a lot of them, are older people. And I think in terms of the common interests of Britain, ensuring that people are educated as effectively well as possible, particularly in a dynamic and competitive global economy, seems to be incredibly important, rather than just a marginal cost which it doesn't really matter to people happens.
Well, with that, I totally agree.
Okay, right.
Absolutely. Education, training, it seems to me that the big failure in public policy over a long period of time has been in these areas. If you want social mobility, which is the point that you were making earlier on, a lot more effort has to go into radical overhaul of the education and training system. And perhaps more money needs to be spent on it. I totally accept that.
I wonder if we actually agree on most things, actually. There is a turn of thought in this intergenerational debate which is extremely alarming, and it's the one that sort of says your parents have betrayed you and you're essentially older generations are essentially evil, or young people are simply whinging and need to get on with life, and both generations object to that because actually far from living our lives in these different demographic groups, obviously we're constantly together all the time. Parents care about their children care about parents.
But you do live with the consequences of what previous generations have done, and you have absolutely no say or vote.
That's an inevitability, but the question is, does government policy look in a sufficiently long-term way at what the effects of kind of short-term political advantage are over generations? And the question increasingly is no. I mean, it always has been to some extent. But if you examine, you know, the archetypal policy that this government says is helping young people, which is Help to Buy, all it's doing is pushing up the cost of housing.
It means that the value of older people's houses.
Yeah, and so the transfer of wealth from one generation to to the older generation who are already homeowners is rising from sort of 1.3 trillion to 2 trillion. I mean, it's epically huge. These are insane amounts of money.
Jeremy.
Well, a Help to Buy is an economically very unsound policy. I wouldn't disagree there. But let's get on to the issue of whether the young today actually enjoy a significantly worse life, standard of living than their baby boomer parents. And, I would think that is... I'm sceptical about that. I mean, again, of course, there are big differences between different income groups. It goes back to the point of inequality across society and not between generations. But it seems to me that the young today have lifestyles that many of their parents, particularly early baby boomers, could only dream of. You know, everybody pretty much everybody lives in centrally heated housing these days. They have repeated foreign holidays, and they have every device, electronic device under the sun, so on and so forth. It's only in this area of do you actually own your own house, what your career prospects are, and so on and so forth. Even on career prospects, I mean, when I was at university, less than 10% of my age group went to university. Now it's nearer 50%. So it was not, for that particular group of people that went to college, we were in demand. It wasn't difficult to get a job, even in the 70s, when, by the way, unemployment was very much higher than it is now.
No one's denying that the quality of life is much higher. I mean, it'd be impossible to deny that. But what's changed is the loss of aspiration. I mean, those things you identify, housing, job opportunities, those are questions about mobility. And I think for the baby boom generation, for the 60s and 70s, for my parents' generation, you see in them and in their biographies a leap up the social ladder, which to me nowadays is inconceivable.
Yes, in fact, surely one of the most concerning things, I mean, certainly for me, probably for most readers of this newspaper, would be what on earth is going to happen to the middle classes in the next 15 to 20 years? Because actually so much of middle class kind of living standards are contingent on home ownership. If younger generations can't get access to the housing ladder until very, very late, if middle class jobs are being kind of hollowed out, which surely they are, then there's a very real prospect that you end up with a new era of downward mobility for vast swathes of the country. Which
but again, this is not a generational thing. You're talking about social mobility, which is a different issue.
Oh, but it does
the rise of robotics, which is doing everybody out of a job, and so on, automation, and so on. These are sort of global trends. They're not intergenerational trends as such. No more so than say the agrarian revolution, which put hundreds of thousands of farm workers out of a job.
Well, maybe that's an important distinction. I mean, the book that I wrote about was about this cohort of the millennial generation, those born after sort of the late 1970s. And obviously all of these issues affect them in a very particular and specific way. They're not always intergenerational issues. That's certainly true. But there are intergenerational aspects to them, not least that government policy increasingly is happy to trap and protect all of those marginal costs that we've just been talking about for older generations, but is less keen to protect those young people who are going to be, you know, the workers and taxpayers of the future. And that is alarming. I suppose the question is, despite the fact that we've got iPads and an impossible number of computer games than ours, certainly in a more consumerist society than we have been for decades, how are the big building blocks of people's lives, housing and pensions, those two big mechanisms that allow people to save, and more generally public and private investment, which allow jobs to grow and the economy to be dynamic, how are those big building blocks translating into good lives for people? And I would say that the government isn't spending enough time paying attention to those.
Final question, Jeremy, Ed, have either of you had to move back in with your parents at any point?
The summer when I left university. So, no.
That doesn't really count.
No.
I had to do it for an entire year.
Yeah, my son did it for an entire year, possibly longer.
But look, I'm from Yorkshire and I want to be a journalist, so it'd be quite hard going to try and do that.
Well, that's true. There'd be no point, would there? Right? There'd be no point. I just found that everything was so small when I came back. My bed was tiny and my feet stuck out the other end. And Jeremy Warner and Ed Hawker, thank you both very much. What is the matter with France? Unemployment is at a near historical high. The nationalist Front National is poised to do well in this year's elections. Government officials are forced to stop performances by a blatantly anti-Semitic comedian. And in the latest bizarro twist, workers at a Goodyear tire plant held their bosses captive to demand higher payoffs for laid-off staff. Everywhere across the country, there is a sense that things are falling apart. Yet there is no great leadership around, ready to show the way out. So how bad are things really, and how did they get this way? Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, who joins us from Paris, has actually written about people fleeing the country in despair. Is this true?
It is true. I mean, fleeing, it's not in millions, because that would be unpractical and difficult. But everybody who either is eligible for the wealth tax or is trying to make a company work in a system where corporate taxes are so high, or is blocked in their career and not finding the job or the career progression that they'd like, is seriously considering leaving, and many of them, we're talking tens of thousands, are indeed leaving for places like the UK, the United States, and Asia.
Right, so is this a generational thing? These are young people who feel they can't break in to what older people have.
No, it is true that people, mostly people between, say, 18 and 40, leave. But you also have older people who leave. You've got people in the midst of their career who feel that it's not worth trying to do more, as you will not get any rewards for it. And it's people who say, I want to retire somewhere else because, quite frankly, I've had it. And if I've managed to behave responsibly and save a little something for my future, then I can't stay, and it will be taken away from me, and I'd rather go somewhere else.
Is this sense of malaise obvious in the popular culture? I mean, are the French talking about it, or is their natural sense of pride mean they don't really discuss it?
Oh, the French have started talking about it. First of all, because we hate it when foreigners talk about it first, and I wrote it in the Telegraph at length at more than 3 months ago, but there has been a piece last week in Newsweek, which was not entirely accurate, because it made sweeping generalizations, which I hope we didn't, but which basically said France is falling, it is not, it is forcing people to flee, it is encouraging no one except civil servants, and it said more or less what we said with a sort of broader brush. So people say, why are people saying this about that? And then the country is sort of divided along the lines of political lines. You've got the opposition, the right-wing opposition, who say, you've got to leave the country, or we have to sort of get rid of this government. And you have a minority who still support François Hollande, who say, you are being unpatriotic. You have to participate in the hardships, as you know, since you benefited from the good times. You've got a large number of people who do not have the means to move. They do not speak foreign languages. They do not have the kind of education. When you're being laid off in France, in the north, in the east, in the mining areas, in the steelworks, where you know perfectly well that you will not find a job, when stamp duty on a house, on buying a house, is over 10%, it's very difficult to move. It's difficult to move your family. It means that if you go looking for a job, your wife may not find one.
Okay.
And the result is that these people have no choice.
Okay, thank you. Benedict Brogan, what's gone wrong?
Well, France is facing a three-pronged crisis. In the past, it's been common to talk about France's economic problems. But what I think everybody is beginning to realize is that those economic problems are being paralleled by a political crisis and a social crisis. One of the measures of France's difficulties is the extent to which its neighbors are now worried about the state of this giant of the European Union, this country that is central to Europe, European economy, and Europe's success in the world, is suddenly going through a crisis which has politicians, certainly on this side of the channel, acutely nervous about France's sustainability, the resilience of its institutions, which appear to be crumbling, the spread of corruption, and the general sense of a kind of national malaise, which, as Anne-Elisabeth rightly points out, those who can are getting out. But what's interesting is for those who remain, there is a sense that the crisis has no issue and that things are just gradually getting worse.
Something I don't understand is, why is there no classical liberal alternative when it comes to economics and politics in France? Why is it everything seems to be driven by protectionism and social democracy and things like that? Why? Because obviously the obvious solution to much of this is deregulation and tax cutting, but no one's making that case.
But that's because French politics for generations bought into, from left and right, into a very particular, the French model, which has been put into question by the economic crisis. And it is very difficult for either side of the economic divide to challenge it. But the fact is, as Anne-Elisabeth will surely tell us, certainly on the right and even on the left, there are plenty of people in France who are putting into question the model. Part of the difficulty, I think, is that France's elites in the media, in the civil service, in government, are institutionally bought into this model and therefore find it very difficult to consider breaking it or changing it.
Anne-Elisabeth, do you agree with that?
Yes, broadly I would agree. You have to realize that there's a very old French tradition of centralism that has worked well for the French in the past. And, you know, you can go back to Colbert and Louis XIV and having everything centralized out of Paris and everything decided top-down. But you can even go to the medieval kings like Philippe Auguste and Philippe le Bel, and it would be the same thing. So we're talking a very old tradition which has enabled France, for instance, in what we call the 30 Glorious Years. It's a historical reference to the 19th century because we like our history here. But building infrastructure, making the kind of 30-year investment that, quite frankly, is difficult to ask the private sector to go for. And so that we built train lines, we built high-speed trains, we built a very resilient electrical grid. We have 80% of our domestic electricity that is provided by the nuclear grid. Anything that requires long-term investment and national decisions is something that has served the French very well, and it has served the rest of the economy because of the externalities. If you build high-speed trains, the French quite buy into the idea that perhaps the rail company is in deficit.
But the other, Anne-Elisabeth, surely the other tradition in France has been that because of the centralized state, there has been the creation of a political class which has done very well out of the centralized state, which has colluded in the development of a political system that allows politicians, for example, to accumulate mandates so that they can be both mayor and député and other things and pocket the benefits of that. And that political class has distanced itself from the public. The thing that is remarkable about France is that it has a vibrant private sector that keeps the economy going, but yet the political debate in France is dominated by the public sector. The thing that is striking about France is that trade union membership in France, for example, is lower than it is in the UK, and yet France and the political classes and the media classes have colluded in an incredibly dishonest political debate, which talks about, rather than talking about strikes, talks about mouvement social, rather than talking about unions and bosses, talks about partenaires sociaux. All these things are designed to hide and disguise the divisions and to effectively stifle the possibility of a debate about the things that are at stake. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why France is suffering hugely, in that after the Trente Glorieuses, there has been a situation of effectively paralysis, because too many people in the political classes who drive well, you know, who have state-sponsored salaries and states-provided automobiles and appartements de fonction that allow them to live on the state, all have a buy-in to this, right and left.
It's true. You're mixing several things. You're mixing several things here. First of all, there has been a movement in the past 15 years at least to a separate mandate so that you cannot be at the same time a mayor and an MP or a conseiller régional and a mayor and that sort of thing. That is changing. It is now seen in France as not such a good thing because you're quite right that there's centralization, but it's really the top civil service. It's not so much the political class. The political class is over-skewed to civil servants because they're the ones who, if they are not elected, can go back to their old job and no harm done. Whether if you're an entrepreneur or if you are a doctor or something, you have to give up your clients, you have to give up your company. And then you go into service as an MP or in government, and you can't necessarily go back out of it, which is why you've got almost 70% civil servants of one stripe or another in Parliament.
Something I do want to cover because our time is short. Is it possible this year that we could see the electoral breakthrough of the Front National?
Yes. And not just, they will certainly make advances at the municipal elections, which are in March, but certainly when you have the Euro elections at the end of May, that will be really the death knell of their sort of being isolated in the French political class, because they might very well come first. These are proportional representation, and therefore Marine Le Pen could very well score 30%. She is finding an electorate on the disenchanted left as well as on the right.
Right.
She might very well sort of gain and become the first party of France. And I would like to remind everyone that the National Front is actually a statist party. She is pro-benefits, yeah, except that she doesn't want to give them to foreigners. She is pro-state intervention. She's pro-subsidies. She is pro-closing the borders. She's protectionist. She is not the dream of classical liberals at all.
Benedict Brogan, finally, what do you think would be the political consequences for France and France's relationship with the rest of the world if Marine Le Pen does well in this round of elections?
Well, given that these are municipal elections, at one level, it doesn't matter. The real question is when we get to the legislative elections and the presidential elections, and you know that's where breakthroughs by the Front National start to have an international effect. I think people will look at it with alarm. And I think what is interesting is that given that Europe and the Eurozone remains an unstable place, the most striking thing about the French situation at the moment is an economic one, in that there is a fear, certainly on this side of the channel, that France's situation is becoming sufficiently politically and economically perilous that it could in some way trigger a renewed crisis of the Eurozone. And while the Eurozone can absorb difficulties in Greece, although at great cost, or in Ireland, in France, if France were to start going down the Swanee in terms of the euro, that would be something that would be unsustainable. So in a funny way, France's political and social crisis and its economic difficulties are really causing trouble, most importantly, among the Eurozone, because they look at this central pillar of the European project and see it as unstable, and they worry what those consequences might be.
Benedict Brogan and Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.